Welcome back to Murder Maniac. This is episode 3. I am your host, Reagan, and last week I ended you guys off with a cliffhanger of the Eastburn family murder case, and so that's what today's episode is going to be about, is the Eastburn family. So to give you a little bit of background before we do get into the story. So there was a family of 3 girls and a wife and a husband, and the husband was in the military and he had to go to military training in Alabama, and him and his wife Katie had called at a scheduled time every Saturday to talk about how their week went and stuff, but one Saturday he just did not get a call, so he had a buddy of his go out and see what was going on, and it turns out they were murdered. So we'll get into the story whenever we come right back after the break. So the Eastburn family, there was 6 of them. There was Katie Eastburn, who is the mother, and Gary Eastburn, who is the father, And they had 3 girls. All of them were under the age of 5, I believe. Like, one of them was 2, then 4, and 5, I believe. So, Gary was stationed in North Carolina. He was an active Air Force captain. And he was stationed in North Carolina outside of Fort Bragg. The city was actually called Fayetteville. And this was in 1985. So Gary got a position to work in the UK, but before they could go and live there, he had a 3-month training in Alabama he had to attend to just to make sure he knew everything that he needed to go and work in the UK. So when he was gone in Alabama, he kept close contact with Katie and wrote letters, and then he also had a phone call at the same time every Saturday. So, now that you know a little bit of background, we can jump into the actual murder story. So, this was Saturday, May 11th, and again, because it's a Saturday, he had a specific time scheduled to call Katie and talk to her and the girls. So, he got no call at all. Like, he was waiting for the phone to ring, and he got none. So, then he decided to call Katie, but got no answer at all. So he called a friend in Oklahoma to go and check out everything that was happening. And so he phoned a sheriff rather than driving all the way out to North Carolina. And so the sheriff said everything seemed in order. And then in the middle of the night, around like 2, he went to the neighbors, and the neighbor said no, and the neighbor was actually kind of aggravated because, I mean, like, he's getting asked about the neighbors in the middle of the night when he's trying to sleep. But whenever the sheriff walked away from talking to him, he looked out his window, and he said something did not feel right. The car wasn't moved. There was newspapers that had piled up days after days after days of newspapers just sitting there. So the next day, the neighbor went to see through the window to see if anything was happening, and he heard a baby crying. So he calls the sheriff, comes, and at the time, they didn't have warrants, and so they did have, like, rules where you can't go in to a house unless, like, you're allowed to, but because no one was answering, and just because of the time of 1985, there was no warrant he needed. So he just went inside, and immediately he said, because he went side of a window. So immediately he said he smelt decomposition. So he then found the baby because he agreed with the neighbor that he did hear a baby crying. And the baby was pale and very dehydrated and sitting in its own diaper and just, it was horrifying. So he said that the baby was about a couple hours away from death itself. So he scouts out the house. Again, smelling decomposition, he's wondering, like, what's going on. He found one of the children by the parents' bed with a pillow covering its face, showing that the baby had been smothered with, or the child had been smothered with a pillow and died. And they looked closer to the child, and the actual cause of death was the throat had been cut so deep that it was that the child was almost decapitated. And again, this was a horrifying sight, and immediately he knew this had to have been a murder, a homicide. So then he goes to the other side of the bed, and Katie was on the other side of the bed. She was stabbed 14 times in the chest. And then the last daughter was found in a blanket, stabbed multiple times in the chest in the child's own room. So he has called Gary, the sheriff did, and Gary comes home, obviously, because, like, there's something wrong, and the sheriff didn't say what happened. He said there had been a death in the family. So Gary comes home, and Jana, the child who, the baby at the time, who had survived, was the only one left, but it took months for her to start talking again. And so whenever she did start talking, she went to a child psychologist to see, like, what was going on. Maybe they could get some kind of lead or anything that could help them out with the case. And all she said was that her siblings were telling her, "We have to hide." So police scout out the house. They get a warrant. They just scouted out. Not really warrants were there back then, but they did scout out the house. And what was missing was a metal lockbox, $300, and an ATM card. So there was a lot of physical evidence there. But they also noticed that there was absence of blood. So obviously they had to have cleaned up. So they did a luminol test, and there was so much blood. There was some in the bathroom. There were some around where the children were stabbed, where Katie was stabbed. There was just so much. But there was also blood on a towel, and they tested it to see if it had belonged to the people in the house who were killed, the Eastburn family. But the towel had an unknown connection, so it had to have been whoever had killed them. It had to have been their blood. So there was also a hair that on Katie's chest, and they tested that as well, and that had no connection again. They also found unknown fingerprints and shoe prints. Now, their first suspect or a person of interest was a man named Patrick, and he said that he was outside around 3 a.m. walking the streets, and he saw someone, and obviously, like, saw someone around the house. And obviously, the sheriff was like, what were you doing around their house around 3 a.m.? And he said he was leaving his girlfriend's house. And then he goes on to describe the man who he saw. And he said it was a tall white man with blonde hair and a mustache. And he had a big nose. And he wore a beanie hat and a members only jacket. He also said that he saw the man he had a garbage bag over his shoulder. So then he was like talking to the guy. Patrick was talking to this unknown person, and he said, and the unknown person told Patrick that he was getting an early start, and then he gets in his white Chevette and he leaves. So obviously they're like thinking, like, we need to figure out who this guy is. Like, this could be our killer. We need to figure out what's going on. So then they find out someone had been stalking her, and like calls came in, and just it was a super creepy situation. So when she put on, she like had flyers out, and it was trying to find a good dog owner to give their dog away, because obviously they can't like bring it onto the fly all the way to the UK. So they were trying to figure out who could take the dog. And there was a lady named Angela who adopted the dog. So the news goes on, again, still trying to figure out who killed the Eastburns. And so the news came out, and they said they were looking for the dog owner because they want to figure out if there's anything that led to their murder. So Angela looked at her husband, his name is Tim, and was like, "That's you. You adopted that dog with me, and you need to go to the police." So Tim was like, "Okay." So Tim goes into the police, and the policemen say that their jaws dropped. So a little bit ago, whenever Patrick was describing the male, the unknown male, that he had them draw out what a picture would be that looked like the now person of interest, suspect, whatever you want to call it. And so whenever the police saw Tim come into the office talking about how he adopted the dog, their jaws dropped. Like, they thought it looked exactly like what the pictures did. So they bring him in for an interview, and he was very cocky and perky. Like, he just, the way he was talking and the way he was just, like, his demeanor was off. So he was talking about how he picked up the dog on Tuesday, which is 2 days before the murder actually happened that they found out. But he does not have a solid alibi. And nobody vouches for him, not even his wife. So the officers are looking at him, and then they go back to Patrick. And then he says that Tim looks exactly like the person. So then they go and they look at Tim's car, and it's a white Chevette. So he's in there for 7 hours of questioning, with the police. So the police just don't have enough evidence. Maybe it's just a coincidence that, like, hey, they've got a white Chevette, that Tim's got a white Chevette. So they let him off, and then neighbors see Tim burning stuff in his burn barrels. Now, this was very unusual because people talked about all the time how, like, he never did this, and it was just very unusual that all of a sudden, after a murder happened, he's burning something in his barrels. So then the police find out that Tim had sent a members-only jacket to the dry cleaners. Now, when Patrick was describing them, he said that he was wearing a beanie and a members-only jacket. So the police are like, this is possibly our guy. Like, everything's lining up. He doesn't have an alibi. He has the members-only jacket. He looks like the person in the pictures. Like, this might be our guy. So they make that on their notes that there was a members-only jacket that went to the dry cleaners. And then Tim's landlord came forward and said that his rent was late, $310. And it showed on the ATM deposits for Katie's card that it had been used. So they're like, this has got to be him. Like, dry cleaners, the rent is late, $310. And again, he took an ATM card and $300 from Katie. So all of a sudden, this next day, he's paying the landlord the amount of money he owes, which is $310, $300 for the actual rent and $10 for the late fee. And he pays it the next day after they are murdered. So Tim Hennis was arrested for first-degree murder, but he was not pleading guilty. They tested all other evidence. Fingerprints, the hair, all of that was tested, but it came negative or inconclusive towards Tim. So then this lady named Miss Cook came forward, and so did Patrick, and they pointed to Tim saying, like, this is our guy. So they're talking about how Miss Cook saw Tim at an ATM depositing money, and this is why she had stepped forward. So her and Patrick point to Tim and is like, this is your guy, like, we saw him do this and this and this and this, and, like, we think it's him. So they showed a slideshow of pictures of the murders of the throat that was slit open from the stab wounds. Just everything was in a slideshow for 90 minutes. Now, the reason why they showed it for 90 minutes, or I'm sorry, it was like 3 minutes and something, not 90, sorry. So they showed it for like 3 minutes to prove that, like, a lot can be done at an ATM, because at first the judge was like, well, the officers were like, oh, I don't know, like, this seems kind of like a long time, or this seems like a short amount of time for him to get money and leave. So they had them sit looking at slideshow pictures for 3 minutes, and to prove that even though it might not seem like a long time, it was a very long time. Now, that was only like 10 seconds. Like, could you imagine just sitting there looking at pictures, gruesome, horrifying pictures, for 3 minutes straight? So they found him guilty once again, because at first they were like, no, it can't be him, because all of the physical proof did not connect to him. So they then again arrest him, and he is sentenced to death for murder. But again, there was no physical evidence matching. So the lawyers of him saw no reason why he should be in jail. But while he's waiting on death row, he got a postcard in the mail. Someone else did the crime named Mr. X. He was talking about in the postcard, it said, like, thank you for serving my time. And it was me who actually did it. But people just thought it was a hoax, and they just kind of let it slide off. So a new trial comes on, and this is whenever the 3 minutes of slideshow pictures come. And so this new trial is 90 miles away of Fayetteville. And they found out Patrick also got into trouble with trials. And so they realized the transaction for the ATM card was 3.5 minutes. So again, they made them sit there to prove how long it was, and then they brought up the members only jacket. Now, they talked to the dry cleaners, and the dry cleaners said they had to use a special chemical to remove the blood. And they said they did not use the to remove blood, like blood stains. And they said they did not use that chemical, that they just did a normal dry cleaning. So they did a side-by-side comparison of a jacket that did use the chemical, and they did a luminol test, and you could still see blood on the one that they used. So because there was no blood traced on Tim's jacket, it was not evidence. So then they go back to the burn barrel. They tested the charred remains, and again, there was no connection towards their murder. Now, the footprints, which was another one, they were 3 times smaller than Tim's. So everyone's like so confused, because there's no hair matches, no fingerprint matches, no footprint matches, and no charred remains from the burn Burn Barrel matches. Not to mention, again, the members only jacket did not show up with blood. So, witnesses say that, so a witness actually looks like Tim, and he's in the audience watching everything go down. And he was talking about how he walks late at night, and he had a members only jacket on as well, and he had a hat. But the police actually took the hat and jacket during the prosecution to, like, still stay on their side and trying to prove everything until they found Tim guilty, because they wanted him to be guilty. So no one knew about that until later, and the policeman did not give his hat and his members only jacket back until he was again on death row, and he was also found not guilty. So they knew, like, this guy's not guilty, and they just let him go. And then Tim was also found not guilty because, again, with all the evidence, it does not add up. So Tim goes back into the army, because outside of prison, that's all he ever knew. That was all his life was. And he became very successful. And at the time, he had a child. So whenever he got out of death row, his child was a toddler. And then he got another child later. And he seemed like a family man. He had a spotless record. And he had a family. He just didn't look very suspicious to people. 20 years go by, and the case is cold. There's nothing at all. Now, something to bring up is, once you're found innocent during something, you cannot get tried for the same crime you committed. So, now it's 2005, DNA has gotten better, and they found a hair match towards Tim. But again, he cannot be tried again. But even though he's a veteran at this time, military laws are different. And they took him in, and he was tried in military court. And they brought up how he went and got the dog, and how his hair matched. And Tim is on death row again, and they say, like, you did it, like, you're the one. And so he is on death row once again, and the judge approved the testing. I haven't really read much about his whole sentencing, but I remember some articles said how he was on death row, and then some others said, like, he had to spend life in prison. I'm not 100% sure. I apologize, but I do believe he was on death row, and then he only had to spend life in prison. But there's still so many questions unanswered, because the fingerprints still didn't match. The luminol test of the members only jacket did not come up as positive. Like, there's still so many questions as to what's going on. Like, yeah, there could be some answers, like, he could have gotten a new members only jacket and then got it dry clean, and he could have been burning his old one into the barrel. Like, nobody knows, and nobody, I don't think anybody will know. And it's such a heartbreaking case, because, I mean, Gary had to come home to his family being dead and him not knowing anything as to what was going on. So that's the story. And I know it was a bit confusing in some places. I apologize. I was confused myself, because it's hard to wrap my mind around everything. Sorry, I cannot talk today. So yeah, so Tim Hennis is his name, was charged for the murders of Katie Eastburn and her two daughters. And we will conclude this episode right after the break. So I want to thank you guys for joining in on me and listening to episode 3 of Murder Maniac. Again, I apologize for the mixed up facts and stuff. I know that was a bit confusing and a bit of a roller coaster. But I do want to thank you for joining in. And I hope you guys come back for next week. And next week will be so much cleaner, I promise. This was just kind of a last minute thing. So, yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed. Today we went over the Eastburn family murder. And Tim Hennis was charged. But again, still so many questions that nobody probably will get answers to. So I hope you liked this episode. And if you did, come back after this week and or go and listen to episode 1 and 2. And I'll see you guys next time. So stay safe and yeah, bye.